Mr. Hafner, you may proceed.
Morning, may it please the court. I'm Jacob Hafner, and I represent Dr. Wong in this matter. I'd like to preliminarily reserve, if feasible, 5 minutes for a reply argument. Medical errors occur. They're unfortunate. And what's even more unfortunate, however, is when certain healthcare providers, as well as facilities, will go to any length possible to shirk the responsibility of their failures and their errors. This is one of those cases. Dr. Wong, an anesthesiologist, took the fall for a surgeon and a hospital that failed a patient. As anesthesiologists are necessary components for healthcare, but never generate independent revenue for hospitals, anesthesiologists are often made scapegoats for healthcare wrongs. To complicate the fate of the scapegoat, as if potential civil liability weren't enough, physicians have the weight of the national practitioner data bank hanging over their head like an anvil suspended by twine. When a report is filed by a hospital, the twine snaps, crushing the career of a physician instantaneously, regardless of whether the report was factual, proper, or appropriate. Once filed, the report is, as has been said by other courts, like a bell that once rung cannot be unrung. Hospitals know this. Hospitals know that under the same law which created the National Practitioner Data Bank, they were also granted broad immunity to make reports to the data bank, so they can use their swift and self-contained peer review process to repaint the picture of what happened during a specific case, and in doing so shift the process of civil liability, which is often slower, away from them and their revenue-producing surgeons, and move such liability towards the scapegoat. Again, this is what happened in this case. While Mountain View Hospital went through the motions in reviewing a most tragic case, what it was really doing was skewing the reality so that the one-year statute of limitations for civil liability in a malpractice case could pass without them or their protected surgeon having to face liability for the death of a young man. Unfortunately, the district court sympathized with the hospital and fell hook, line, and sinker for the fiction that they simply engaged in an unbiased peer review process to improve quality. That's not the case. If that were the case, then the hospital would have generated and engaged in a meaningful investigation of all the facts relevant to the patient's care in this matter that did not happen. One of the most interesting parts of this case is that when all the facts became known in the civil litigation for malpractice, a plaintiff's attorney actually on his own dismissed the case with prejudice without any financial settlement for fees or costs because the case against Dr. Wong was that weak.
Mr. Hafner, in this particular case that we're dealing with and part of the underlying as to the HCQIA situation, Mr. Wong, in the hearings before the hospital, and I use that term sparingly because I know you dispute that, represented himself. And there's a record that indicates he was advised of the process in a timely manner, had the ability to cross-examine, and so on. How does that play into where we're going in terms of the action before the district court and the dismissal?
We dispute whether or not he was informed in a timely manner. That's one of the issues that we've provided evidence on. Doctors are conflicted when they engage in this process because they are told by the medical staff personnel that this is really a conversation amongst doctors. This is peer review. This is an opportunity to benefit from the collaborative discussions amongst the panel physicians and the physician whose care is being questioned. And Dr. Wong believed that. Dr. Wong received communication simply from the hospital chief, physician, the medical staff chair, and came with scholarly articles prepared to talk about medicine. And what he found himself in, unbeknownst to what he thought he would be finding himself in, was a much more rigorous and formal adjudication of the case. It was his own choice not to consider and seek counsel for that hearing, quote-unquote. However, under the circumstances, and remember, totality of the circumstances is a critical factor to whether immunity will be provided. Under the circumstances, Dr. Wong felt that he didn't need a counsel because he thought this was going to be a collegial interaction between him and his peers as physicians.
Well, Mr. Hafter, to follow up on Justice Douglas's question, the issue under HICWA is notice. Now, there's a December 24, 2008 letter. I assume you're not disputing your client got that, notifying him of the hearing and specifying the letter says what the letter says.
The letter says, but we're not going to dispute what the letter says. We're going to dispute the timeliness of it. They sent it out on Christmas Eve.
That's what I want you to explain. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry for interrupting.
By all means. They sent it out on Christmas Eve to an address, whether or not it was the correct address or practice address or the like, which generally physicians' offices are not very easily accessible during the holidays, especially an anesthesiologist who's not seen patients at his office. He sees it's a billing office generally. So he did not receive actual notice until several days later, well beyond, which shortened the period, the 30-day period, and all of these details are outlined in the brief specifically.
Yeah, but before the hearing, he got it.
Well, before the hearing, he went, and he sent, well, upon receiving notice, he asked for various information. He asked for copies of the records. He asked for copies of the expert reports.
Let me restate the question. Before the hearing, he got the letter.
He did.
And at least a couple of weeks or so before. So your argument is that
less than the 30 days required.
Okay.
And HICWA does not just require notice. There's four circumstances, four elements to whether or not HICWA immunity will actually be provided to the hospital. One is they don't specifically say notice in and of itself. It's adequate notice and hearing procedures are afforded to the physician involved, or after such procedures as are fair to the physician under the circumstances. So it's not just a note. It's not a technical, we gave you a letter, boom. It's, do you have real fundamentally fair hearing procedures that will give somebody an opportunity to prepare for a defense? In this case, he's asking for copies of the reports. He's asking for copies of the charts. He's asking for all the documentation, and they're not responding to him. That evidence is in the record. Now, how are you supposed to actually obtain an expert to come support you when a notice is mailed during the holiday season? You may get the notice sometime late December, early January, and you have the hearing on January 24th or 27th, whatever the day may have been. I mean, it's fundamentally not fair to the physician. And then couple that onto the fact of the physician wasn't given access to the records, to the documents. No expert would be able to review the case and support Dr. Wong in that case. You are setting him up to fail. And so it wasn't fundamentally fair, which means it didn't fit within the third element of the HICWA requirements to provide immunity. But regardless,
wasn't Dr. Wong queried at the beginning of the hearing at the hospital as to being prepared to go forward and the process and so on, and did he basically say, I'm ready to proceed?
Dr. Wong is a gentleman who did say that.
And
you've got to understand the culture of a physician and in that proceeding. And they are very timid and reluctant to actually create a scene or create objections or advocate for themselves, because the entire culture of how a physician is trained and brought up is in a subservient manner. And so he thought it was a collegial atmosphere, and they said, are you ready to proceed? He was as ready as he could be. He didn't realize, though, that he had an opportunity to really make an objection with respect to documents and the like at that time. He just wanted to talk about the medicine, and so he did say, yes, I'm ready to proceed, and tried to get into the medicine. Interestingly enough, the record shows that when he tried to show scholarly articles and talk about the concepts of shock and the like, he was criticized and ruled, said it doesn't apply, and yet what we later find out in the civil case is from the coroner's report, the coroner actually attributed the death to shock. It was exactly what Dr. Wong was trying to point out in the scholarly articles, which the panel never let him address or bring in. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time. There are no further questions.
Okay. You may do so, Mr. Hafter. Thank you. Mr. Bailey?
May it please this honorable court, again, my name is John Bailey. I'm from the law firm of Bailey Kennedy, and I'm here on behalf of the respondents. Let me first go to directly the questions that you asked Mr. Hafter and why it's very easy to try to sidetrack what the lower court did, because what the lower court did was exactly what it was supposed to do. This case is as close to textbook in how a hospital is supposed to handle a situation like this as you can get. But let me start with the first question, I think was from Justice Douglas, which is Dr. Wong decided to show up at the hearing without counsel. Mr. Hafter happens to be the third lawyer who represented Dr. Wong. Dr. Wong had counsel before the hearing. For whatever reason, he chose not to have that counsel at the hearing. He then had another counsel after the hearing, which is all in the record, and then Mr. Hafter shows up in May. Remember, the hearing is in January of 2009. Mr. Hafter shows up in, I'm sorry, the hearing is in January of 2009. Mr. Hafter comes in May of 2009. Dr. Wong did have counsel. This is now his third set of lawyers to help him in this regard. The second question that Justice Douglas asked, I think, or maybe it was Justice Hardison, was about the notice, the 30-day notice. And you correctly pointed to the December 24th letter that was sent to Dr. Wong. The hearing wasn't until January the 27th. And Mr. Hafter's argument is, well, it was kind of a Christmas time and it perhaps did not give him sufficient time. Well, the point is that statutorily it fit what it was required to do, which was to give him at least 30 days notice. What you don't find in the record at any point is Dr. Wong saying, you know what, I don't feel like I have sufficient time to do stuff here. Can I have a continuance? What you find is exactly what you alluded to in the fair hearing transcript is when you ask the question, do you have any objection to the composition of the fair hearing panel or to proceeding at this point in time? And Dr. Wong says, no, I'm ready to go. Now, their response to that is, well, you know, he's a little bit timid, and he thought this was going to be a collegial kind of hearing. No one looking at the notice from December 24th, 2008, and the prior letter from the NEC saying, we are going to recommend the revocation of your privileges, would somehow conclude that this was going to be simply a little fireside chat where we're going to just sit around and talk about this case. All of the safe harbor provisions that are set forth in HICRA, which are the same, virtually identical, the provisions that are set forth in the medical staff bylaws are contained in that December 24th letter. The right to be represented by counsel. Now, that doesn't suggest a collegial kind of fireside chat. We're just going to shoot the breeze about a particular case. The right to call, examine, and cross-examine witnesses. Now, we don't know what was going through Dr. Wong's mind. And you know what? For the purposes that you sit here today, it's not important because it's a reasonable, objective standard. And we have the presumption that we met those standards. The record is clear that we met those standards. And what we see is whether Dr. Wong thought it was going to be a collegial situation or not, the objective standard is that he received adequate notice and a hearing. Now, one of the questions that they raise is, well, the lower court could not have known all of this stuff at the time that it dismissed this case. And that's the first dismissal that occurred back in 2010. The point is this. At the time that the lower court, Judge Herndon, looked at this matter, all of the facts had been established. And here's what Judge Herndon looked at. And he looked at all of this because he attached Dr. Wong to his complaint, a complaint that had over 300 verified allegations. He attached virtually all of the evidence as exhibits, there's over 100 pages of exhibits, to his complaint. And what did those exhibits include? It included, of course, the December 24th letter. It also included the fair hearing transcript. And when we moved to dismiss, the only issue they raised was there adequate notice and a fair hearing. Judge Herndon had before him, at the time that he took this issue up, the actual written notice, which you've alluded to, the December 25th letter. He also had the transcript. Now, it's entirely possible that someone could say in a written notice, you have the right to examine and cross-examine and call witnesses, but at the time of the hearing, somehow he gets denied that right. But when you look at the transcript, you see just the opposite. You see that, one, he didn't call any witnesses, although he did provide testimony himself. Did he cross-examine the MEC's witness? Absolutely. When you look at the transcript, you see that there was a robust discussion between Dr. Wong, Dr. Pearson, who's the vice chief of anesthesia, who did one of the reports, between Dr. Wong and the members of the fair hearing panel. And while it's not appropriate for us to look at the medicine and try to substitute our judgment for their judgment, what you have is a robust process whereby Dr. Wong was confronted with concerns about his clinical judgment and concerns about his airway management. Now, one of the things opposing counsel brings up is somehow that the hospital is laying off liability or judgment against Dr. Wong instead of the surgeon. That's not the point. First of all, it's not the point because that's not what actually happened. Everybody who was involved in this particular patient's case had concerns that the hospital had to address, including Dr. Wong. This case was about Dr. Wong. This fair hearing was about Dr. Wong. It was not about the surgeon. The surgeon's fair hearing was a completely different issue. What happened in this case was not that we're pitting doctor against doctor, anesthesiologist versus general surgeon. What we're doing is saying, look, Dr. Wong, we believe what you did for this patient was below the standard of care.
Mr. Bailey, it's been presented to us, even though it wasn't talked about in the opening, but it was briefed, besides the issue of fairness and a proper hearing, are issues related to discovery in the district court proceeding under 56, where they said they proffered certain requests for discovery, certain things weren't provided, the court made some rulings. And if you comment on that, and also as to the issue related to dismissal of contract claims in light of bylaws.
Okay. First point, first issue that you raised is the discovery issue. As you know, this court has, in its appellate review, standard review, the district court has wide discretion in terms of how it conducts discovery and how it may limit discovery. This case was initiated in August of 2009. From August of 2009 until January of 2012, Dr. Wong and his counsel did zero discovery. They didn't do any discovery for 2 years. Now, admittedly, there was a portion of that two-year period of time that this case went up, was removed to federal court, and then got remanded back. But for essentially a two-year period of time, they did no discovery.
On the evening, having said that, discovery was propounded. There was a certain response to some of the propounded discovery, but there were other items that were not responded to. the reasons, but I'd like to hear why or why not in the court's position.
The reason is because when we moved to dismiss based on the HICWA immunity, the only objection to the four elements that Dr. Long raised was the third element, adequate notice and hearing. That's the only objection he raised. He conceded that the hospital did its inquiry and furtherance of quality health care after reasonable efforts to obtain the facts and in the reasonable belief that action was warranted based on the facts that it knew. He conceded those three elements. The only one he challenged was adequate notice and hearing. The discovery that he propounded 30 days before the discovery deadline asked for certain information that did go to that third element, and then the rest of it was a fishing expedition about everything else. We responded appropriately and provided the information, the answers, the documents, once a protective order was put in place, to those requests that dealt with that third element, which is the only element that was an issue. The other items that he asked for, which were irrelevant and had already, they had already conceded that those points the hospital had met. So that's how the discovery process happened, and that's what Judge Herndon recognized. And if you look at his order, he indicates in his order, and I can point you to the citation because I have it right here, that the plaintiff received and was provided with appropriate discovery given the defined nature of what the court was looking at with respect to the four HIPAA elements, three of which had been conceded to. Your second question was
contract and bylaws.
Contract and bylaws. The reason why the contract and the rest of the claims were dismissed was because the HICWA immunity is an immunity to all claims that relate to damages. And those contract claims and the other claims were damage claims. The only area where the immunity does not apply would be for things like injunctive relief. And you'll recall in this case, initially, Dr. Long sought a TRO and a preliminary injunction to prevent the hospital from complying with the federal reporting requirement. That came before the court. We could not assert the HICWA immunity on that because HICWA immunity only goes to claims for money damages. And the court properly denied their request for TRO and preliminary injunction, stating that I can't enjoin the hospital from complying with federal law, which we have an obligation to, a mandatory obligation under federal law to comply.
But to follow up on that point, although I've read the complaint, although the complaint talks about damages with respect to each of the causes of action, the prayer seems to invoke a declaratory relief or equitable relief to reinstate the doctor's privileges, which would be a different issue than the hospital's obligation to report. And as you noted, wouldn't be covered by a HICWA defense. I was going to ask you to comment about how we should address that.
I'd be pleased to, and we have to go no further than your decision in Village Association versus City of Reno, your 1989 decision, where this court, consistent with, I think, every court in the country, said that the Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act does not establish a new cause of action or grant jurisdiction to the court when it would not otherwise exist. In this situation, you can't have a declaratory relief claim independent of a primary claim because it is not a claim that is separate and apart from a primary claim. In the initial complaint that they filed, their request for injunctive relief was attached to all the claims that for money damages that they had asserted. Those claims went away with the immunity, and in this situation, the declaratory relief would go away as well because you can't establish an independent claim just based on declaratory relief.
Your reference to prior action, was that state action or action in the federal district court?
Excuse me?
Was that action in the state court or the federal district court?
That was in the state court. Yes, it was in the state court. It's before Judge Herndon.
Okay. Are there any other questions by the panel members? All right, thank you, Mr. Bailey. You have a minute left if you want to sum up, or do you have anything further to add?
In sum, let me just say this. This hospital, my client, as I indicated, did a textbook investigation of this. It started with all of the incident reports. It started with an internal investigation and internal reports by the vice chief of the Department of Anesthesia and the chief of surgery. It then went outside the hospital setting and went to an independent, nationally recognized group to get an external peer review report. It asked Dr. Wong himself for his response. He gave a written four-page response. And after all of that information, and there was really no other information to get from anyone, the recommendation was made for the revocation of his privileges. The process was appropriate because it then gave Dr. Wong the opportunity to have a fair hearing. His peers at the fair hearing, an anesthesiologist who happened to be his partner, an internal medicine, a cardiologist, a gastroenterologist, and a neurologist or a neurosurgeon, peers of his, asked him the best questions about what happened, what were you thinking, why did you use this device to try to manage the airway versus a different device. Based on all of that, they concluded, and the hospital, after their appeal to the Board of Trustees, concluded that his clinical judgment was impaired and that his management of the airway for this patient was below the standard of care. The hospital, a private facility, has the right under those circumstances to revoke privileges, and that's what it did.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bailey. Mr. Hafter, your rebuttal, sir?
I have significant concerns about a lot of things that were said. I never knew that Dr. Wong had counsel before the hearing. Not on the record, that's new. I don't think that it was his partner that was a real partner that was on the panel as an anesthesiologist. That was new. But I need backup, and I need to emphasize two things. One, HCQIA immunity does not come into play until the summary judgment phase, clearly established by the Ninth Circuit, as well as most federal courts, because it's a federal law. Even Bryan versus James E. Holmes Regional Medical Center from the 11th Circuit, it's a question that's resolved on summary judgment. You should not have your hands handcuffed while you're trying to get to that stage to be able to defend the four aspects of HCQIA immunity. They keep on focusing on the one, and they want to make it a very technical notice requirement. That's not what the third requirement for HCQIA immunity says. There are four requirements. Okay, we did not concede anything in an opposition to motion to dismiss. All we said is we don't know because we haven't engaged in discovery. And what it turns out is the second requirement, for example, whether there was a reasonable effort to obtain the facts in the matter, was not present in this case. They never sent what the surgeon did to an outside peer review organization. They never looked at the surgeon. There was no surgeon's fair hearing, even though it was kind of alluded to that in argument. That stuff should have come out. It's not just about Dr. Wong. It's about the totality of the circumstances for the care of this patient. Did they really do a reasonable investigation in this case? There's no way that we could have ever found that out unless we had the benefits of civil discovery, which we didn't have. Our hands were handcuffed. And there was no understanding or justification as to why. But we provide plenty of examples and all in the briefs about how we did not have information on the totality of the circumstances, whether they made a reasonable investigation. The other point is this notice requirement. It's not a technical notice, but even if it is a technical notice, Dr. Wong didn't have 30 days. They sent it via certified mail. He picked it up on the 2nd, which was a reasonable time given the holiday calendar, and he went to the hearing on the 27th. That's not 30 days notice. Moreover, within a week and within days, he's making requests of the medical staff office for information. He's having questions. They're ignoring him. That's not fundamentally fair, which the third requirement says, after procedures that are, quote, fair to the physician under the circumstances. It's not merely notice. And that begs the question of whether or not the court was right in this case of limiting the discovery. We didn't sit back for 2 years. We were in a quandary as to how we prevent this bell from being rung, which we knew could not be unrung. And we have this is a situation I'm going to show you all the time on, is how do we manage the data bank? Because it's a federal law, and yet for a private hospital, we have no federal cause of action to go into court. So we go into courts that are state under breach of contract claims, because that's all we've got, and they say, well, we don't have the power to enjoin the reporting. Well, they may not, but they have the power to enjoin the finalization or the enactment of the discipline, which then wouldn't trigger a data bank. They have the power to reinstate the privileges, which would prevent the triggering of the data bank. This is a serious issue for physicians, and in this case, Judge Herndon wanted us to try to go up and deal with it on federal causes. So we went to bring in the United States government on the data bank issues, and it got removed to federal court. We didn't stall for 2 years on discovery. Again, whether or not there's an acquittal immunity resides on whether or not it was fundamentally fair to Dr. Wong, when you have them not giving information and just forcing him to go to a hearing and not being responsive to his request of information and telling him it's a collegial interaction, he shows up ready to just talk medicine, they don't allow him to present the evidence he has, they don't allow him to have a proper time to get an expert, it's not fair to him. And we need some protections in the state for physicians, or we're going to keep losing them, and we wonder why our health care is going to be so bad as it already is. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Hafner, thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Bailey, for your arguments and your briefs in this case. The matter will stand submitted. We appreciate your input this morning.